Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series Conference. Today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Amy Papageorge. Please go ahead.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for Cigna's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series. My name is Amy Papageorge, and I'm a therapist and care manager for the outpatient alcohol team at Cigna. Due to the format of this seminar, you will not be able to ask questions during the talk, but there will be an opportunity to ask questions at the end. Following today's presentation, you will be asked to participate in a brief 5-question survey so that we can get your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After the survey, you will be able to ask our speaker questions regarding his talk. Please limit your questions to the seminar topic. If you have specific questions regarding substance abuse treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. There is a PowerPoint for today's seminar available online. To access it, go to www.cigna.com/substance-abuse and then click on today's presentation. Again, that's www.cigna.com/substance-abuse. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Tim Trail. Tim is the director of the Substance Abuse Resource Center at the University of North Texas. He has extensive experience working with substance-using patients in treatment facilities, homeless shelters, and at the group and individual level since 1999. He is presently seeing patients and conducting research on addiction and brain functioning. Tim?
Hello, how are you? You don't have to answer that, of course, because I can't hear you. And as you can probably get from my first intro, I'm kind of loosey-goosey, so I'm not going to use a bunch of big science words and that kind of stuff because it kind of bugs me when I hear it, too. Anyway, I am here at the University of North Texas right now. I hope you guys have a chance to go to the PowerPoint and look at it and get to see everything. It's mostly pictures and a lot of little stuff here and there. I'm just kind of going to use it to go along and support the things that I'll talk about. I'll also reference some of the things that I see just in case that anyone does not have access to a computer or you just don't have time or, heck, you just don't want to do it. That's okay, too. So let's get started. The second slide is a picture of Homer Simpson with a brain that's about 1 inch big inside. It's like an X-ray. It's a pretty funny one. So if you haven't looked it up, you need to look it up because it's pretty funny. Basically, I want to go over a few things today and hope I can just clarify some of the things that have to do with the brain and addictions. And I use Homer Simpson a lot. I have him a couple of times in here because he's just great. I work with the University of North Texas, so the population I work with is about 36,000 students between 18 and whatever. We have some in our 60s here. They're going to school, so I get to work with about everybody. And I also work with staff and professors and anybody who needs help or anybody who wants to just sit down and chat and talk about things or finds himself a little too deep in the rabbit hole. The third slide is also a picture of Homer Simpson, and it's one of my favorites because it has this, it shows the inside of his brain and what he thinks about. Sleep is really huge. Donuts, pretty big. Then it says sweet, sweet beer, which if anyone watches a cartoon, that's his big deal. And really, I want to help find out what's going on inside of our brain. His brain's probably not the best one to look inside, I guess, but he's really funny and the students love it. So the next slide is just kind of a generic switch transition slide. And it says things like rehab and hope and choice and those kind of things. And there are so many books out right now. I went down to Barnes & Noble and looked around, and there's just, I can't even begin to count in the self-help books and the addictions area. And there's just tons of them, 20 ways to overcome addiction or 7 ways or 9 ways or 50 ways or whatever. And there's lots of books and lots of information on the internet, and I even have a lot of students come in here who've been in counseling for a long time or they've been to treatment centers, and I hear the word choice thrown around a lot, and willpower, and, well, you just got to, when you're ready, you're going to decide, and then you'll quit. I hear that a lot from parents, specifically, and in my past from just spouses and family members and friends and all the people who care about people. But there's so much more to it we've discovered just through, I mean, science is so quick now. We're making hundreds of discoveries every day in many areas of science. And in addictions, we're making quite a few discoveries too, and we're figuring more and more out in the brain as we go along. And so those are some of the things I want to talk about. We'll just kind of throw down some of the basics today on addictions, personality, those kind of things, and then we'll jump right into the old noggin, and I'll start telling you guys some of the things that we've discovered through the past and other places through research, and also here in our research lab at University of North Texas, we've seen over and over. I do get to look into people's brains, not literally open them up, but electrically, and that's what I do. I work in the field of neurofeedback, and I get to see regularly what people's brains look like with anxiety, severe depression, ADHD, drug and alcohol addiction, you name it, we get to see it, and it's very, very interesting. The next slide, 2, 3, 4, 5, which is the fifth slide down, it says three roads toward addiction or abuse, and there's actually more. These are the three basics we're going to talk about just on this slide. And one is born into addiction, which there are children whose moms and dads or dads have used during pregnancy or during conception. And those things really do affect the child, and we've seen that neurologically. Children come out from having an addicted-looking brain, which I'll talk more about as we go, all the way to a mother who's just used all the way through, who the child comes out already going through withdrawal symptoms. So that's one way that we've seen. And then also the genetic disposition, and we hear genetics a lot. And I'm sure that everyone on the phone has heard genetics, and how does genetics play into that, and is that true and is it not? And there are a lot of things we still don't know about the genetic disposition of a human being and how it kind of moves us along. But there's a lot we do know now. One thing that we do know, for instance, a child or even a grandchild of an alcoholic is going to have no alpha in their head. Alpha is an electrical activity. That's all it is. It's just electric in the brain. And that's what our brain does. It's full of electric all the time. And there's a few different levels that they go by. Delta, beta, alpha, beta. And there's some more, but those are the main ones. Delta, the very lowest, is when you're asleep. The next one up is theta. That's when you're kind of asleep. You can see lower end theta, dreaming, REM sleep, things like that. Or if you're really tired and you're almost asleep, that's also theta. People can get down into it meditating also. Alpha is when you're kind of just generally sitting around, relaxed. You can figure out what's going on. You know, nothing here nor there. Low end of alpha is meditation also, which is great. I'll talk about that later also in regards to drug and alcohol addiction. Now, a person who's a child of an alcoholic or an alcoholic themselves is going to have no alpha in their head, which has nothing to do with intelligence. But when a person drinks alcohol, any human being, no matter how much they drink or if they even never drink, they're going to experience a spike of alpha when they first start drinking. Alpha is not one of those things. No, this is not like when a person does cocaine and they go, woohoo, this is awesome, and there's this huge, overwhelming feel. But this is more in the middle part of the brain, which is tends to be subconscious. So it's kind of like that part of the brain leans forward and goes, hey, whatever that is you're pouring into this mouth right now, do that more, because I want to know that's awesome. And so it's this thing that we don't notice, but there's a behind-the-scenes thing happening that's working towards, this feels normal. I feel normal right now. That's awesome. And so that's something that we do know genetically is passed down, and it's one of the genetic factors, at least that we know about now, that we believe we know about, that pushes us that way. Another part is that a person who is and not all 100%, but most, are going to experience the child or grandchild of an alcoholic, are going to experience becoming drunk differently than other people. So I have a lot of young people in my office, when I find out right away they're a child of an alcoholic or a great-grandchild, I'll say, oh, I bet you could drink all your buddies under the table from the second you started. Yeah, I could, or whatever. And then when I go, yeah, and I bet you probably don't even get a hangover, do you? And the answer is almost always either, well, not very much, maybe I'm a little tired, or nope, I don't. And then about that time they go, wait a minute, how'd you know that? And I know it because children of alcoholics are great-grandchildren or grandchildren even, don't experience those things in the same way that a person who has never dealt, or their family above them has not dealt with that. So genetically, they have not been set up the same way. And that's dangerous because you don't have that consequence. I mean, if you don't wake up the next day and go, oh, I wish I didn't wake up at all, then a person is more likely to go, well, let's just go do that again. Woohoo, I don't feel anything. I have no headache. So genetically, that's something that many people don't understand or know about yet. It's just not very widely spread through even the scientific community yet, but it's something that we see regularly in neurofeedback. Then we see on that same slide, I skipped a three, by the way, on that, but we're still on the same slide, which is number two, is you can work yourself into addiction, whether you drank or whether or smoke weed or whatever, or your parents did or did not, doesn't matter. You can definitely dig your hole, so to speak, and plant your tree and whatever you want in it. Most of the people who come into my office have worked themselves into wherever they're at, if they're that far. The brain just, that's the way it works. I mean, you can use until you're addicted if you use enough and often and the amount. And we'll get into those a little bit later, too. So the next slide, which is six, is called predictors in people. These are general behavioral features of a person. This is kind of the character of the personality. You hear, oh, I've got an addictive personality. And these are, and that's what this is. This is speaking to people who have tendencies to, we see their behaviors. Those are people that we can say, they might have a problem later with addictions. And it's pretty easy to see that, at least the potential of it. It's not 100% for everyone, of course, nothing is, but that's how science goes. But these things, such as impulsivity, meaning they just stand up and do whatever. Where are you going? They just stand up and walk out the door and I want to go do something crazy. You know, and they go off and do whatever, just kind of impulsive and do that. That we see a lot. And we can see that in the brain. I have people hooked up over here when I first get a patient and I can say, oh, do you tend to be a little impulsive? And, well, yeah, how'd you know that? It's right there. I can show it to them. Family of origin, of course, along with addictions, along with genetics, if a person environmentally is surrounded enough by it and they see it enough, we can see brain structure change in someone who's in a certain environment. And so, over a period of time, and so if a person is around an uncle or an aunt or a brother and a sister, and doesn't have to be a direct bloodline down from a mother and a father or grandparents or whatever, that affects them, that affects their brain and the way they think and the choices they make. People are affected, no matter how strong you are, you're affected by everything around you, every part of the environment. It affects our brain. Our brain is built to do that. It's built to remember things so that it can either protect us or help us to get reward or whatever it is, but that's the way it's built. Nothing you can do about it, on that basic part. But there are a lot of things we can do. To kind of manipulate it a little and make it healthy and work it out, those kind of things. And I'll get into that a little bit later. let's see, what else is on here? Family origin, coping skills, which really comes from environmental also and even family. I meet a lot of young people in here, and one of the main reasons that they're in here, I mean, they're in trouble, of course, for smoking weed or drinking alcohol or doing Xanax or whatever, but the main thing I see is they have no coping skills. They've not been taught how to cope with life. That when things go bad, it's not the end of the world, or, you know, things are not so black and white. It's just not this way or that way, and that's all that can be. Or when they experience a huge loss in life, they've just never been taught or never developed those coping skills. And coping skills will normally be heard in treatment or in counseling. When it comes to addiction, you'll hear the word coping skills because those are things we have to learn all through life, including when it comes to handling addiction or getting sober or getting clean and staying that way. If you don't have coping skills, then that's a bad way. That's an easy way to slip into the addictions arena. But if a person has slipped into it, and he or she still doesn't learn coping skills, it's a great way to slip right back into it. At some point, we're going to have to get healthy and have to learn how to handle these things. Genetics and epigenetics is on here. Genetics we talked about a little bit already. But epigenetics is different. Epigenetics is how a person, well, it is different in a way, but it's the part that I was explaining about. A person may drink 3, 4, or 5 beers the second, third time they've ever drank, and they're with all their buddies, and they're saying, not much at all. This doesn't affect me hardly at all. That's the experience of the alcohol. Epigenetics is how a person experiences the chemical. And so that comes from genetics. And it also can just come from just the way that the brain has been set up for a million different ways, because there's a million different things that can happen as we're growing up, a hit in the head or a different environment, or we move into a certain place and certain things are happening. Everything influences our brain structure. And so it also, and depending on our brain structure, that's going to determine how we experience every drug. I'll talk a little bit more about it in a couple of slides, but I have a great example of epigenetics. And the next one down is assumptions. Self-perception is humongous, humongous in addictions. All the other ones are too, but the reason I'm saying this one so intently is because this is the one that's looked over a lot, because we're looking at, before we looked at willpower and choice and these kind of things, and those were sort of more of a moral, medical base way of looking at things. It's just this way, you've got to choose, you've got to be stronger than this thing, that kind of stuff, which plays a role in it, but there's so much more to it than that. But assumptions and perception is humongous. It's really big. We see it in everything from drug and alcohol addiction to anxiety, to depression, you name it. It's just there. And it really influences us, and it really changes the way that things happen. And those are the filters that we see everything through. For instance, I ask students regularly, how many people do you think drink at the University of North Texas? Give me a percentage. And most people say about 90% drink. This is a regular basis, like every weekend. Well, it's a college. Of course they're all going to drink. And everyone I see around me drinks. Well, that's because their filter, what they're looking, their eyeballs, what they see is they see everyone drinking because everyone they hang out with drinks. So filter has a lot to do with it. And it goes from that all the way to how alcohol, for instance, how alcohol is perceived from that person's family is an accepted thing, is it a horrible thing, is it an evil thing, is it a way to relax, All those things play a part into it. And then self-perception itself plays a huge part into it. What kind of strength or self-compassion is what it really comes down to. How do they see themselves? How much of a break do they give themselves? How much judgment do they have on themselves? And those things really can drive addiction. They can, because before addiction ever happens, they're driving brain structural change. Your brain will actually change and be manipulated, physically change, just in the way you think. That's just amazing. I wish I could see all of you so I could say, isn't that amazing? And you would say, oh, my gosh, are you serious? Because that's what I hear everywhere I go. For instance, if someone was sitting here in front of me and I told them that, something negative. I don't want to say anything specific, because, and you'll see why. So if I say something negative to this person about five or so areas in their brain, a large part of their brain lights up, becomes electrically active, because the brain sees that as an attack. Now, if I know this person, and I just love them to pieces, and they're my best friend, and they know I'm joking, I'm laughing, they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that I'm joking. Well, unfortunately, the same exact thing happens. And through fMRIs, not here at the college, but this is other research studies, we've seen that it doesn't matter if your logical part of your brain says, oh, I know this person, I totally know they're joking, whatever. It doesn't matter. The middle part of the brain, which I'll get to in a minute, sees that as real life, and it takes it as, that was an attack. They're attacking me. Oh, got to protect myself. And even though we may not feel that protection happening, it doesn't change the fact that it's happening. And so if you're around that kind of environment, in that negative kind of environment enough, we can watch in labs, we can in fMRIs and EQEGs and EEGs, we can watch brain structure change. And if it changes that easily, just on words, you can imagine if a person puts a drug into their brain that massively affects it, how much change can happen. So it's a lot more than just, well, they made a choice and they kept choosing to do that, and that's their own daggone fault. Well, maybe the first, time or two or whatever, but as brain structure begins to change, we're getting a little more into anatomy now. Not so much will and those things as much as anatomy. Will can still play a part because it can influence still, but anatomy has changed. So if anatomy changes, so does the psychology of a human being. You can't get around it. There's just no way to do it. So let's go on to our next slide, which says, what are the mechanisms of addiction? Genetics, one we talked about before. And the next one, tolerance, is the next one down, and tissue dependency is the next one down below that. So tolerance and tissue dependency I have on the same page because it's the same thing. I always hear it's way nicer for when I'm talking to people in here in my office and I say, oh, you built up some tolerance, hadn't you? And they go, oh, yeah, I can drink anybody under the table or whatever. And then when I say, well, the real term for tolerance is tissue dependency. And then that's when all the blood drains out of their face and they go, what? Oh, my gosh, that sounds so bad. And tissue dependency is, and you can go to the next slide, by the way, it's addictive mechanisms. Tissue dependency is, that's our body's way of adapting to a drug or something that is there that should not be there, or it's something new into our brain or new into our environment. Our body adjusts to it. Human beings are built to adjust. If you're in an environment all the time where you're surrounded by negativity and attacks and really aggressiveness or any of those kind of things, your body is going to begin to adapt. And I have heard people over and over say, well, mine did, and I just backed away and hid my cave and or I, you know, withdrew, and, you know, that's what I did. Well, that's adapting. You know, there's just no way around it. The body adapts. It tries to protect itself, whether it's becoming quiet and withdrawing, or whether it's becoming aggressive and defending, or trying to just stop that from happening. The body adapts to it. So when a drug is introduced into the brain, or the body for that instance, it almost immediately, well, not almost, it immediately starts to adapt. And so it's going to go, whoa, this is so far off balance. This is crazy. And it immediately starts to try to figure out, this is so alien to us. We've got to figure out how to catch our balance now. This is just putting us on a super bad way. And so what happens is the brain tries to start to normalize itself. And so it starts to see that imbalance as balance. But especially if a person drinks often or smokes weed often or does anything often, the brain is going to say, oh, that's supposed to be here. This is supposed to be how it works. This is obviously normal because it's here all the time. And so since the brain does that, it immediately starts going, well, we need to balance everything else out because this is how it's going to be from now on. And so this is a great example. If you take, let's say, Advil every day, a good strong one, you take it every day, that's an analgesic. Take any kind of analgesic, aspirin or whatever. So take it every day, good strong amount of it. After about 2 months or 3 months, somewhere along in there, whatever it is, depending on the severity of the drug, your brain, here's what happens. You take an analgesic, a painkiller, that's what I mean. Take a painkiller. The brain makes a painkiller already. It makes a natural analgesic. And so as you're stuffing these painkillers in our face, our brain goes, you know what? We got plenty of this stuff in here. It's coming in every day. We don't need to keep making this. We got other things to do. We've got other places we can put this energy. We just don't need to do this. This is silly. And so it just kind of assumes that that's going to be there. And so after about 2 months or so, you quit taking that painkiller. The chances of you getting the worst headache of your entire life have just shot through the roof, because you're probably going to get it. The severe headache until you take a painkiller, and then it goes away because you don't have any painkiller in your head. And that's what tissue dependency or tolerance is. It's that whatever feature or structure or chemical is there all the time, whatever changes have happened or are happening, the brain sees that as normal and natural. And so it starts to adjust. This is the normal way to be. And we need to replace things and move things around and take some away from here, and we can excess it and put it over there, just not use it at all, whatever. And so that tolerance starts to get there. That's why when a person, and if no one's ever consumed alcohol, I'm sure you know someone who has, and it's just a great one to use because so many people have known someone who's drank. And so if you think about it, the first time, or you can at least even imagine, the first time a person takes a couple swigs of alcohol or drinks one or two beers or whatever with their buddies sneaking out back or whatever, through a pretty hefty response, usually, almost always, unless it's a child of alcoholic, then it takes a little more. But usually a pretty heavy response. And I'll tell people in here, oh, you remember that first time you took those couple of beers? Oh, yeah, I remember that. I drank three and I thought I was going to die and falling over and so I was so drunk. And, oh, okay. So how many does it take to get to that place now? And usually we're looking somewhere between 7 and 10. And so then it starts to sink in a little bit. And then they come back, well, wait a minute. Is that tissue dependency yourself you were talking about? Yep, that's it. You know, and it's that the body and the brain has went out of balance. And so now it takes more to get there. And this is one of the things I was wanting to hit on real fast, which was when I was talking about people being able to work themselves into it those kind of things. There is also self-medication. I have a friend who was severely addicted when they were younger, and the thing is they said it's a young lady, and she said she used to sit around in a big group, and they would all bring in different drugs and everything, and she just hated anything that got her down or anything, any kind of depressant. But every time someone would bring in a stimulant, she would get really excited about it. And so she would sit in this huge circle with people, and they would have cocaine, and everyone would snort them some cocaine, and everyone would be bouncing off the walls and ready to go run a marathon down the street or whatever. And she said she actually all of a sudden just felt really normal, like not hyper, not too out of control, but just felt like, I mean, she was hyper-focused, and she could feel that intense, you know, moment. But if she did not too much, she said she'd feel really normal. And that's because later she has found out that she has a severe chemical imbalance in her brain. And so when she's given a stimulant, much like an individual with ADHD, has too much sleepiness in their head. A lot of people don't know that. ADHD is not just a massive load of energy all the time. It's that they have their frontal has too much sleepy. That's logic and all those kind of things. But the middle of their brain has lots of energy. It does have too much energy. And it's freaking out. And so if this person has a little kick of a stimulant, let's say a Mountain Dew or a cup of coffee or an Adderall, which is a stimulant, start to feel pretty normal. They start to come down off of that. They don't have to be so full of energy just to try to stay awake. And so there's a lot of things that you guys can ask doctors about and learn. And you know, the brain stuff's amazing to me anyway. But anyway, I don't want to get off too much off a track. So, okay, let's go to the next one. So we're 9 slides down. That's just a little bit of the background. I've kind of rushed through it. These are the one things I've rushed through are things that a lot of times people are told in treatment centers or told by many counselors now know some of these basics. So I don't want to spend too much time on the basics and the mechanics of just the drugs themselves. So let's go into the brain. So there are 4 major parts of the brain that are affected by alcohol and other drugs. There are 3 major parts of the brain that overall that were developed through whatever, whether you believe in evolution or whether you believe that's how God made us, he made 3 or evolution developed 3 specific areas in the brain. And in these, there are 4 not so much areas, but processes that are in certain areas. And the first one is the prefrontal cortex. So if you take your hand, you slap it on your forehead right in the front, that's your prefrontal cortex. Most people know that's where logic, decision-making, happiness is up there, memories up there, all that good stuff. Now, the part that most people don't know that's up there is the inhibitory part of the limb of the brain. So inhibitory part meaning that it is in control of the rest. It tells it when to stop, tells it when to chill out. It tells it, hey, you're going a little far now. You need to calm down. That is up there in the prefrontal cortex. Now the second area just back from the prefrontal cortex goes from ear to ear, so to speak, across the top of the brain. That's the motor cortex, and actually the sensory cortex is in there too. And that's where walking and, you know, those parts when a person gets drunk, they're falling over, that's because that part's pretty messed up. It's been saturated. And so that's the next thing back, balance, those kind of things. And it goes down in the cerebral area and that. But overall, that's the motor cortex. Now, the second part of the brain, which is kind of listed as a third part down, but the first part, major part of the brain is the frontal, right in the front of your head. And the second part, major part, is the limbic system, which is in the middle of your head. So if you pointed right above your ears, right in the middle, and from top to bottom, right to middle, and front to back, right to middle, that's where your limbic system is. The limbic system is fear, rage, anxiety,
sex. If you won the lottery, that part of your brain would be flipping out and going, woo! Reward is in there. That's a major part, is reward. And that's where addiction is seated. And that's because of that reward system. And also, it's a mixture of the fight, flight, or freeze, as we call it, is in there. That's our animals have that. All animals have it, including humans. But all animals don't have the prefrontal like we do, the logic and the decision-making and those kind of things. This part, everyone has. Now, the next one back is the autonomic nervous system. So if you patted yourself lightly, not hard, but lightly on the back of your head, that big melon part back there, that's the autonomic nervous system's area. And it goes kind of down into the brainstem. And that's heart rate, blood pressure, core temperature, hunger, digestion, those kind of things are there. And so now we're going to go on to the next slide. We're 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14 slides in. This is how does it all come together. So you've got the prefrontal cortex. We're going to skip over the motor. But the limbic system and the autonomic nervous system. So let's say you and I are walking, the person you heard in the beginning, Amy. We're walking down through the sidewalk together. And Amy and I see something green and wiggly in the grass right next to us. All fluid looking and scary. And, oh, no, is that a snake? And so what we do is, let's say I run and start screaming at the top of my lungs like a crazy person. I'm running through traffic, almost getting hit by cars. Now, on the other hand, she says, what is that? Or she may jump down and karate chop it, or whatever. Either, both of us, that is our limbic system acting first. Our logic part doesn't go, well, let me see, what is this? It just doesn't work that way. Our limbic system is built to protect us. All animals have it. That's why they bite you, run away. They may freeze and hope you don't see them, or whatever. But those are protectants. And we have that also. And so that guy works first. And then he sends a signal up to the prefrontal cortex. That's the logic part. And the logic part says, Amy, that's a water hose. And then Amy's screaming at me, Tim, come back. That's a water hose. That's not a snake. And I'm off, getting hit by a car or whatever. Because my logic's not working at all. So that's basically how the brain works. It's very, very basic. But there's a reason I'm explaining it to you. So the next slide down, well, past that one actually, is a person going, ooh, that was close, and then they shows a water hose. But the one below, there next to that one, it shows a brain of a normal brain and then someone who has it's a depressed brain activity. And that depressed part is not from being depressed, it's from being an alcoholic, because an alcoholic is a depressant. And so, if you could see that slide, if you can't, the person who has not been drinking or has a normal brain activity is all lit up and there's lots of activity and it's really colorful and nice. And then the brain that's been drinking for a good long time is very dark and there's not as much electrical activity. And electrical activity is really important. The next slide says two basic pathways to structural change. The first one is reward system hijacking. The second one is the changing of power differential, which they really have to do with each other. It's just one comes before the other one. So the next slide says pathway number one is hijacking the reward system. So if you don't have the slide, I want to ask you this. It says ask yourself a question. What would be better than a great dessert? And I spelled that wrong. Anyway, or a steamy evening with your significant other. And so then the next slide says the reward system is all about pleasure. If the drug makes the level of pleasure experienced an unbelievable amount, like super mega high, then you've just been hijacked. The next slide down is this really neat little graph, and I'll explain it to you just in case you can't see it. The first part is for food, and it shows about what the dopaminergic dopamine is, a chemical in your brain that's released when you're experiencing pleasure. And so if a person has a really, really good meal, it jumps about 50%. That's pretty daggone high. Sex, and someone has sex with a loved one, or well, I guess with anyone if it's pleasurable, it jumps 100%. And so it kind of gives you an area, a level to measure by. Now, cocaine, it jumps to about 350%. So you can see the lure of that, how it can hijack the brain's pleasure pathway. Methamphetamine, on the other hand, is only a mere 1,200% above that. So it's literally 1,100% higher than sex, is the feeling that a person would be getting from this dopamine being released of pleasure. So the next one says pathway number two is changing the power differential, and this is where we kind of come into it. So the drug of choice goes in, and it kind of smashes that prefrontal cortex. Really, what it's doing is it's lowering the electrical activity in the prefrontal cortex. Now remember, when we saw the snake, so start thinking about that and applying it, because the prefrontal stops the rest of the brain from doing nutty stuff, right? And so what it does is it does a couple of things. Number one, it lowers the electrical activity in the prefrontal cortex. Number two, which is the next slide down, it makes the limbic system, I got this picture of this muscle guy, that's me, by the way. No, I'm kidding, it's a cartoon. but anyway, the limbic system becomes very powerful and very muscular, and really, it's becoming very electrically active, and we can see it actually growing over a period of time, too. And remember, the limbic system is rage, sadness is affected through there, love is affected through there, those kind of things. And so, on the next slide, it says, the prefrontal cortex is no longer strong enough to stop the limbic system. So the system can pretty much do whatever it feels like doing. So let's go back to the snake, right? So Amy and I are walking down the street. Amy looks down and sees this guy. And she immediately, her limbic system says, watch out, that might be a snake. And so she reacts by stopping, maybe getting a little distance, things like that, what she needs to do. But then it sends that signal forward and says, is this a snake? And Amy's frontal says, no, that's a, let me use a little logic here. That's a water hose. Chill out. Calm down. Well, it calms down. And so my brain, on the other hand, I've been drinking for way too long or smoking for way too long, or I'm in the middle of being drunk. Don't have to be an addict. You can just be drunk. It does the same thing. It's just on a shorter period of time. My prefrontal is not working very well. So my limbic system sends that fit signal forward and says, hey, is it a snake? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm too crazy. I've got too much nothing in my brain and in my frontal. And so I just run for it. Because my limbic system is saying, do something right now. And when it sends that signal back, I don't know if it's a snake or not. The limbic system says, there's no answer. It doesn't have to be a snake. It must be a real threat. React right now. So, and that's kind of what happens neurologically over a longer period of time. That starts to happen outside of experiencing the drug. So alcohol, methamphetamine, weed, whatever, we're seeing this power differential where the prefrontal, and if you go to the next slide, you see the snake versus the water hose, but the next slide down from that, you see the prefrontal is smaller. The limbic system is much bigger, and that starts to become that way all the time. So it isn't just that when a person is experiencing the drug, they can't make good decisions, and they can't, and they're losing their willpower, and they're losing their ability to be logical, and, you know, and why can't you get that through your thick head? This is really bad for you. Well, because the limbic system is much bigger at this point. And so a person who is in addictions is working more out of fear, anxiety, rage, protection. So it's working more out of that protect or attack or flee or freeze than it is anything else. And so you see, it's not as easy to access those things as you or I may be able to if you have a loved one that you're thinking about, or a friend, or you've seen someone who's experiencing this. It's not as easy for them to access those kind of logical thoughts, because logic ain't working so much anymore. And the limbic is just driving, we need something, which not only does that, but the brain is out of balance now, see? So if the brain's out of balance, and I'll wrap up this pretty quick, but because I don't want to take up too much more time, but if the brain is out of balance and it sees that out of balance as normal, when a person stops, let's say stops drinking alcohol, in about 2 days or a day, they're going to start wanting to drink pretty bad. the brain is going to say, okay, this is not natural. We're no longer in our what we consider to be a balanced state. So that's a threat. Something's wrong. Something's happening. We need to put more juice into the face of this person so that we can get back in balance because our stabilization is threatened. So that what originally started out as like, oh my gosh, I'm feel so drunk and you know, this is I feel from being drunk. Originally, that was kind of the thing that made people feel, you know, out of balance. Now, it's not being in that unstable place, in that drunk or high or whatever place that the brain is tricked, and it sees that as being unbalanced now. And so it takes that as the threat, and it pushes the person to want to use, to want to experience that high again, because that's balance to it at that point. And it takes time to rework it. It takes time to get that balance differential back. And if we don't teach coping skills and all these other things, it just doesn't. And so we'll skip down to the next one. It just says what the limbic system does, the alert system, and then go down to the next one. So low prefrontal activity, that's just kind of a funny one, to be silly. And so we got a few things on the last three or four slides. There's a few things that I wanted to go over real quick. There's alternatives. So, and this is why it's really important to understand that the whole argument about is this a disease or not, is it willpower, is it my fault, is it their fault, is it my fault I can't quit using because I'm just not strong enough. And you can see that it's so much deeper than that, that it's not about will just. I mean, we did simple research on taxi drivers in London. When they first started driving taxis, we measured their hippocampal and hypothalamus and all these structures that had to do with memory, and then measured them again in 3 years. They had grown so much larger because they were forced to memorize all these little streets. And you can see that it's not a matter of necessarily will, especially if a huge drug's in there, like hammering it to change into the way it wants. It's so much deeper. I wish I could go on for 2 or 3 hours and we could really get into it deep. but anyway, what works and what doesn't work, and that's different for everyone. Some people love Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, and they swear by it. Some people don't. Some people love treatment centers, and some people don't. Face-to-face, being with a psychologist or a counsel, and medication. Medications are pretty big. Medications will change a person's brain structure over a long period of time. So that's something we got to balance, and we have to know about. But I really wanted to get into some of the alternatives, and I'll do it really fast. Some of the things that some people have not thought about. Self-talk is one of them, and that comes in the beginning. And that's why I said if I said something negative to someone, that brain takes that as negativity. If I say something positive, only about a third of the brain reacts in a good way, and it doesn't act for very long, which is kind of off balance, but our brain's made to protect us. And self-talk's huge. We can see brain structural change in people who talk negatively to themselves all the time. They take it just equally as an outside threat as anyone else, as if someone else were saying it. Self-talk's huge. So it's something to really be careful about if you're talking with someone else or if you're watching them talk to themselves and how we encourage that. Self-compassion. I mentioned that earlier. Forgive yourself. All those things, because if you don't, they increase brain structure in more of a negative way than positive things would. It increases us towards healing and towards soberness and towards being clean. A drastic move is on there. And that's sometimes people just have to take themselves up and put themselves in a different environment completely. They move everything, their friends, everything they own is just gone, and they move somewhere else. And the problem is if you don't have coping skills and the self-talk and the self-compassion is not there, most people usually slip back because the brain is the brain, and you can move yourself anywhere, but you can't move your brain without some work. The last two, one is meditation. Meditation, not some religious crazy stuff, although you can do that too, but meditation, I've got a load of research and I've presented it a long time. Meditation actually increases alpha in the head. just breathing and concentrating on how you feel as a human being, your body, your muscles, and that's it. Not trying to empty your mind or none of that junk. But you can see if a person becomes an alcoholic or is from an alcoholic family, they have no alpha. And so you can see, I mean, I'm just touching the iceberg. I wish I could go on forever, but meditation is an amazing, has amazing research behind it for PTSD, alcoholism, drug addiction, anxiety, tons and tons and tons and tons. And the last one is neurofeedback. Neurofeedback, we see this huge differential. So we see this huge lack of electrical activity in the prefrontal and a huge, a massive amount of energy in the limbic system in someone who's addicted, right? And so with neurofeedback, we can literally watch that electrical activity and we can literally prompt a person to change it. I've watched it over in the lab many times. Drug and alcohol addiction has a huge, huge, huge outcome, a positive outcome. And it's something to really check into also. It doesn't work for 100%, but most. And we can change that. We can make that small little circle get bigger, the logic part and the inhibiting part, and that big giant limbic system circle get smaller. They're just very simple. Now, let me give you a contact for them real quick. If you want to look for a BCIA counselor, which is biofeedback is what it is, neurofeedback. If you go to bcia.org, bcia.org, at the top of the page, right in the center, it says find a practitioner. And you can just click on that, put in your zip code, I think, and it'll bring one up in your area. But anyway, bcia.org. I wish I had so much more time, but I went so far over. Amy, are you there?
I'm here.
See, I talk too slow. Okay. I better wrap it up, though. I don't want to go too far.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Trail. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. Number one, this session provided me with a basic understanding of how drug abuse affects the brain. If you strongly agree, press star 1, agree, star 2, disagree, star 3, strongly disagree, star 4. Just one moment. And I apologize, I need to do that first question again. This session provided me with a basic understanding of how drug abuse affects the brain. Strongly agree, star 1. Agree, star 2. Disagree, star 3. Or strongly disagree, star 4. Number two, this session educated me on alternate treatment options for drug or alcohol abuse. If you strongly agree, press star 1. Agree, star 2. Disagree, star 3. Strongly disagree, star 4. Number three, overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. For strongly agree, press star 1. Agree, star 2. disagree, star 3, or strongly disagree, star 4. Number 4, I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or star 2 if you do not agree. And our final question. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Star 1, I am a person with substance abuse issues. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with a substance abuse issue. Star 3, I am a treatment provider for someone with a substance abuse issue. Or star 4, for other. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 to have your line opened into the conference. Again, it is star 1 if you have a question. And I do have some questions. I'll open the first line. Caller, please state your name.
Hi. Thank you very much. This was a fascinating program. I was wondering, could you recommend some resources for further study on this topic?
Sure. Well, there is a, as far as the meditation part goes, the university, or what is it, the hospital up in, anyway, Dr. Lazar. Is her name?
And it's Lazar?
Uh-huh. And Dr. Benson, Benson, is actually her mentor, but they both do a ton of research on the effects of meditation and anxiety. And I've taught on a lot, and most of their research points at anxiety and those kind of things and PTSD, but that literally the difference in the brain through fMRIs and QEGs and neurofeedback, through anxiety, PTSD, and alcohol and drug addiction is almost, you almost cannot tell the difference. And so we've seen huge improvements by implementing meditation or breathing exercises even, which you can get really off in any smartphone now. That's one really, really good one. Let's see. And then there's a book. Oh, let me think here. And then the BCIA website can also point you towards a lot of neurofeedback books or neurofeedback conferences or neurofeedback information. There's a whole bunch in there. Is there anything else specifically? I'm sorry?
That's really good. And I assume that some of these have also been researching some other health behaviors that may have an addictive component, you know, eating behaviors, exercise behaviors. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And I do have another question. I'll open that line.
Oh, yes. I was wondering how often have you noticed, like, being that the overlay of addiction that maybe people have one addiction, they conquer it, like now they say, like people who've had gastric bypass have a food addiction, but then they become either like sexual addicts or addicted to alcohol. Like, how do you conquer that with multiple addictions? Like, you go from one addiction to another addiction.
I think that's why it's so very important. I probably should have said this in there, but I think it's why it's so very important to understand that it's a neurological thing. That it's not just
you know, it's understanding that, and all the counselors that I speak to, I teach them these things because they don't need to be a neurologist, but if they understand the neurological underpinnings of it, you know, I have it in here all the time in my office. I just had a young person who smoked weed heavily for about 3 years, quit, then, and within 2 or 3 weeks, drinking like a fish, you know, can't stop drinking. And so I worked on that. And then another 2 or 3 weeks, sex. I couldn't, you know, just stop drinking, but just having sex. And it's because of that limbic, that displacement of energy. If we don't learn, we can go to AA all we want. The thing I've seen with AA and other treatment facilities even is that people constantly need it because they're not fixing that power displacement in the brain. They're just, you know, stopping the thing, but it's still there. They still have this limbic system that is pushing them for a reward or pushing them for balance. The young lady I spoke about, because it doesn't go away, is the problem. Once a neuropathway is formed, it stays there forever. But you can weaken it a lot. And not having that kind of knowledge that it's neurologically based also, that's a huge part of it, is brain structure. Really kind of, it really causes us to set a lot of people up, or ourselves to set ourselves up. You know, well, I've quit doing that, but now I can't quit doing this. And it has to be a matter of, and really there's so much I want to tell you. But it's learning those coping skills and going through it, but also implementing other things like simple meditation. Most counselors still teach that as a coping skill, but it's actually part of a coping skill, but it's also restructuring the brain, which will dampen the need for any addiction. Because like I said earlier, that literally the difference between person with sex addiction, cocaine addiction, and post-traumatic stress disorder in the brain, you can't tell the difference. I mean, literally, you cannot. The limbic system's on fire. The prefrontal cortex is too weak to control it. So it's learning those skills to increase the prefrontal cortex's activity. So then the more you do it, it's just like drugs. The more you do it, the more electrically active it is, the stronger it becomes and the bigger it becomes. And the more it can stop the other stuff from doing whatever the heck it wants to do. Does that help at all? Or?
Yes, that does. Yeah, very much.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
And one final reminder, it is *1 to ask a question today. And it appears there are no further questions at this time. Ms. Papa George, I'll turn the conference back over to you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Tim, for speaking today. If you have additional questions for Mr. Trail, please contact him at the web address listed on today's PowerPoint. If you have specific questions regarding treatment or your policy, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to mark your calendars to join our next Drug and Alcohol Awareness Seminar. It'll be on August 21st. Our topic next month will be Farming, the New Way to Party. Thank you.
And that does conclude our conference today. Thank you all for your participation.